open session. General Robert N. Davis presiding. All of our business before this court is under and shall be heard. God bless the United States and its honorable court. Please proceed.
Good morning. I'm Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Scholin. To my left is Judge Bartley. We're here today in the matter of Harvey against Shulkin, docket number 16-1515. I have two issues for consideration. Whether the claimant's attorney, who is also a doctor, may provide a medical opinion in the claimant's case, and if so, in what manner should the opinion be presented to the board. And the second issue is whether the board erred in finding no new material evidence had been presented that was sufficient to reopen a claim of entitlement to service connection for tinnitus. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Mr. David Ice for the Mr. Harvey.
Robert Morris for the Secretary of Defense.
All right, thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, is it Mr. Anice, did you say?
Yes.
Do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
Yes, I do. 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay. Gentlemen, everybody ready? All right, Mr. Knights, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Davis, Your Honors, may it please the court. There's nothing in the Model Rule 3.7 that requires or even permits a disqualification of a medical testimony. Rather, when there is a conflict, and a conflict arises when the attorney is in trial, usually before a jury, and whether he is a necessary witness, which is defined as an eyewitness, eye or hearing, as facts that he knows about personally, under those two conditions, he may be disqualified. He would be asked to remain as an expert or a witness in a trial, and another attorney of his firm will replace him. That's basically the content of 3.7 and the case law that the Secretary has provided.
Mr. Nice, I have a number of questions for you. Let me start by making an observation. You've kind of put yourself in a very peculiar predicament, representing your client and offering medical opinions as well. I think it would be wonderful if every veteran in the country had a doctor and a lawyer to consult with. I mean, what better qualifications can one ask in representing veterans but to have a medical background as well? So I think that's phenomenal. But it does pose some particular problems, it seems to me, here. And I just have some very practical questions for you. To start, why not get another doctor to offer an opinion?
Because the field of veteran disability is so unique and expertise in that field is so rare that I challenge the court to actually identify people that are knowledgeable. I have written a book about veteran disability. I've dedicated a whole chapter to the issue of sleep apnea as it pertains to PTSD and other conditions. There are just not many knowledgeable doctors in the field that offer their services to veterans. To my knowledge, when you look at the field of IMO, people who provide nexus letters, I'm aware of only three people for practically millions of veterans that require IMO that provide it. So we have a necessity to have an expert. I agree with Your Honor that it is beneficial, and especially in a setup like the BVA, where under manual cited as reference 7 in the secretary, the VA has to have fully and sympathetically developed the records. And the veterans comes and says, I have this expert who really knows the topic, and he wants to shed light on how to evaluate the case and help the BVA in finding the scientific and reasonable conclusion of that dilemma. And I cannot for the life of me see any objection to why this testimony will not be in.
Well, so you're suggesting that in your practice of medicine, you do not know of any practitioners who, in consultation with you, you could have simply asked them for an opinion that would have perhaps looked to be more objective and not provide an appearance of bias or impropriety because you're both representing your client and offering a medical opinion. You mean to tell me you can't find any practitioner in, where are you from, Massachusetts?
Say it again?
Where do you practice out of, Massachusetts?
I don't practice anymore. I used to practice in this city. I was a surgeon at the Washington Hospital Center.
Well, where are you currently?
Currently, I don't practice medicine. I practice law.
Where are you currently practicing law? What state?
In Arizona.
In Arizona. Okay. So you mean to tell me in Arizona, given your experience, you can't find a doctor who you could consult with and ask for a medical opinion, rather than put yourself in this position?
Well, there are two issues that you raise, Your Honor. One is there a doctor that can cover all the topics?
Now, we're talking about sleep apnea. I'm not talking about all the topics. Sleep apnea. There's an article in the record on sleep apnea. We're talking about sleep apnea. No doctor that you know of can give you an opinion on sleep apnea.
Well, I may be able to find a doctor that does sleep apnea, but then I will still have to find a doctor that knows something about PTSD and something
I understand.
About tinnitus.
I understand. Let me ask you another question.
300 other cases.
I understand. Let me ask you another question. How many times have you represented a client as an attorney and as a physician before the board?
I'm sorry. I didn't understand the question.
How many times have you served in a dual capacity of an attorney and a doctor in representing a client before the Board of Veterans Appeals?
Well, actually, in my first brief, I actually put the references of at least two other BVA cases that they had no problem.
I understand what you said in your brief, Counselor, but I'm asking you a question. How many times have you done this before the board?
At least three times.
Okay, maybe. If I look at your case that you cited in your brief,
yes,
in the record, right? The board accepted your opinion, your medical opinion,
yes,
correct? But it also characterized it as a June 2014 letter and clearly identified you as Dr. D. Anice. That's not the way your, I'm hesitant to call it an opinion, but that's not the way this issue came to the court as a separate letter. It came in the form of your brief, correct? In this case?
In this case, it came, you're correct, yes.
Okay. So, I'm just curious, sir, have you ever had any concerns about serving in both capacities?
I think that they are related, Your Honor.
I'm not arguing the fact that they're related, but we also have model rules of professional responsibility that go back to the original canons, Canon 19, and then the codes 5-101, and now 3.7. Did that ever cause you any concern?
No, because I can tell you that even in an adversarial system, and I was in a and was an attorney that practiced medical malpractice initially. And I would have no problem as a doctor and a lawyer to do all the work that was prior to appearing before a jury. When it came before the jury, I had to have an expert. And the reason, and I was also an expert witness, so I've been in both sides of the issue. It's practically impossible to be in an adversarial position, be an expert witness, and field off the question and field off the objection. And so mechanically, it's impossible to have a doctor and a lawyer before a jury. But when it came out to opening statement, I had no problem.
Right.
When you have a deposition, when you have pretrial motions, summary judgment, all those things, I never felt that there is any conflict.
Well, everything I've read shows that there's a split. There's not a real good answer in the material, in the cases, in the law review articles. I get that. But I'm just wondering, do you feel like you can be objective in offering a medical opinion when you're representing a client before the VA?
Your Honor, it was a subject of my substantive paper when I was in law school, dealing with expert witness and objectivity. And I think that the courts have made it very clear there is a case that I didn't cite. It's in the Supreme Court. It's Black and Decker versus Norwich. I think that I have this citation here. It is 538 U.S. 822, that the court made it very clear that doctors that work for the insurance companies are biased and they will say what the insurance company wanted to do. I'm not saying that this is uniform, but the court have established, because of that concern, they established criteria how to evaluate doctors' opinion, which is different from lawyers' opinion. And the way they do it is either by Nevis in this court, by Dubert in the federal court, and by Fry in the state court. In all those cases, the motivation of the expert is non-existent. It's not even an issue. The issue is he telling us something which is based on science and it's reliable? And I can tell you regarding credibility that if you were an expert witness like I was, and you embellished once, only once in your entire life during depositional testimony, that would be the end of your reliability, credibility. So you build your credibility. So doctors who do it more than once are usually extremely careful to be extremely reliable and actually do tell you both sides of the issue. They tell you the strength and they tell you the weaknesses of their opinion.
Let me just ask you one other question and I'll stop for a while. But in what form would you typically characterize a medical opinion? How would you submit that to an administrative department or
Well, I think that the important thing is when it comes to the issue is the same issue that is defined as necessary witness. That means that I do not present my own bias, my own personal opinion, or my own personal observation. I don't examine the patients. I don't come to the court and say, this is my result of my examination, and this is how I plan to proceed. I rely on science. If I have to describe, for example, issues of standard of care, I would not say this is how I normally do it. I would say that this is how the Society of Orthopedic Surgeons define the standard of care for that particular
patient. Counselor, I understand that, but you also offered an opinion, as I understand your argument, based on a treatise, a medical article. And my question is, in what form as a doctor, do you usually submit a medical opinion? Because your, as I understand what I've read, your opinion in this case is that your client suffered from sleep apnea that was caused by PTSD.
Correct.
So how do you submit that opinion to the court or to the board?
And this is where the treatise is so important, and as Wallen have shown, it's something that the court usually relies on, and that is that I do not present evidence. I educate. I connect the dots. I basically take the evidence as it is in a C file, and I pull up the treatise. I analyze the treatise because I have expertise in analyzing treatise. I was an editor of the...
If I can interject, I think the Chief Judge's question is a little more basic than what you're interpreting it as. Do you send a letter? Do you write it in your brief? Do you present oral testimony? I think that's your question.
I think that's right.
So when you give this opinion, in other cases that you've done it, have you given a letter to the board that's separate from your brief? Have you incorporated your opinion in your brief? Have you testified in person at a hearing? What format are you providing this opinion?
Normally, my practice usually involves providing an IMO first. When I have a client that is in the process of filing for a claim, I provide him with an IMO. When he's being denied and I take on the case, I already have the IMO. So basically, yes, you can have also an IMO, which is has a certain language, which usually relies on treaties, and present those treaties with the IMO. So that would be a normal thing. This case...
And your IMO is usually...
An exercise.
A distinct letter where you sign it as a doctor.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, and this case is a little unusual in that I did not have an IMO because I did not see this client before. I took it directly to the board. But, and in some cases that I have now, I actually have a little paragraph that explains who I am, my CV and so on, so it's become more clear. But I don't see an ethical issues involved in doing both, and they are actually cannot even be separated. The advocacy that's involved in providing those opinions and the opinion itself, as long as it's a opinion rather than a personal evaluation or personal examination of a patient, I think that they are one and the same.
Okay, so you usually do not submit a co-joined brief and opinion, as you did in this case?
I have, in those cases where I started with an IMO of it, who did not represent the client, and the client then came back... because he was denied and asked me to represent him, then I would basically attach the IMO to the brief. And I'm not even saying that this could not be in the future a way to overcome this obstacle. I mean, I can write an IMO and attach it to the brief and say, well, this is the medical part of this is, you know, in case that somebody feels that they may be confused by the dual role, but...
Uh-huh. Okay, one more question. This brief that we have, I am looking... let's see where it begins. On... R at 82 on the record. And so you have a few pages of writing... and in the text there, your argument is that you presented a medical opinion. And then on the very last page of your brief, that's R at 89, there's a note that you CC'd the veteran on this without enclosures. And then you say down below that enclosures, see attached chart for numerical list of exhibits. Is that, I didn't see a numerical list of exhibits, and in fact, at the record, the only thing I have, unless my record's incomplete, is your Milosiewicz article? Dr. Milosiewicz, is that how you pronounce his name?
Milosiewicz, yes.
Milosiewicz, yeah. So that's the only enclosure or attachment that I have. Did you attach all? Did you have a list of other enclosures?
There were a. When I look at the, when I printed out what I have, there was at least five enclosures. There were five cases cited there, but at least the Milosiewicz is the important one. So I'm not sure if it could have been an error on the part of my staff. I can't really. I don't know what the answer to that question is, if whether or not there were other enclosures in addition.
Okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure if the enclosure, when you look at it, the article itself, there are references
right.
to some articles, and maybe the enclosure just means that we referred it rather than we actually printed out the, I don't know, it's been a long time since I dealt with that case. I don't remember what exactly was done.
Okay, now the board addressed the Milosiewicz article.
Yes.
Did it not? And it made the point that the article established merely a correlation
yes.
relationship and not a causation relationship between PTSD or psychiatric disorders and sleep apnea.
Yes.
And so I was trying to figure out what your argument was in your brief, or maybe it was your supplemental brief, but I think it was in your regular brief. You addressed this and appeared to be saying that because certain Agent Orange rules are based on correlations, that is, some of the Agent Orange conditions were based on correlations instead of causation, that here, I guess, what was the your argument that the board was in error in rejecting the Milosiewicz article on the correlation basis?
Well, let me explain my position on that. First of all, in manual reference 7, he basically said that the system itself does not require causation; it requires temporal relationship. That's basically the language of manual. But in addition to that, we have a system, the entire system of the BV of the VA adjudication is based on the premise of more like or as likely as not. The very definition of as likely as not, meaning that you look for temporal relationship between the service of the veteran and the condition that he has. And under that kind of rubric, when you have to rely on epidemiology, which has been the mainstay of medicine. But in epidemiology, when you have a drug that you test, you put two groups in, a control group and a tested group, and you say, this drug cured 8 out of 10 people, so it's an effective drug. In a control, it helped only 3 out of 10 people. So that's how you do it. That's how the entire medical process is that. We know very little how actually causation occurs. We don't really know in most conditions how things actually happen. We only know correlation. So I give an example from Polovich that basically we structured it. And it's a good example from Agent Orange that what they did is they said, people that have cardiac condition, Agent Orange caused it. How do we know? We know because people who served in Vietnam had a certain percentage of cardiac condition. Those who did not serve in Vietnam and they were matched in other way did not have as many. That's why cardiac is that. Then we go to another condition. We said,
I understand what you're saying.
We don't know how it happened. Uh-huh. We don't know.
But in this case, you're arguing that the sleep apnea is secondary to his depressive disorder slash PTSD.
Correct.
Right?
And the reason we're saying...
And secondary service connection has a specific rule, 3.310, that requires kind of like proximate cause, if you're... Or aggravate, you know, that secondary service connection is, I'm just looking at the regulation here, disability which is proximately due to or the result of a service-connected disability can be service-connected secondarily.
Correct. So we start...
So that sounds like proximate cause and not like a like it would allow a correlation.
Well, the correlation is the first step. The correlation basically says that if you have a group of people, like with this article, that 79% of them had either PTSD, depression, and so on, and the control group, which is the general population, have only 7% sleep apnea, and here you have people with sleep apnea, but 79% of them are having this condition, then it's statistically significant. It's not only as likely as not, it is statistically significant. The two groups are very different statistically. Now, the next step is to establish either a how, you know, what the mechanism that, that this happened. And I did present it, unfortunately, not to the BVA. I presented it to you as an illustrative thing, but basically it goes to the heart of understanding what sleep apnea is. And sleep apnea is a disease of sleep. It's not a disease, it's not a respiratory problem. It's a disease that happens only when people sleep. And it's caused by...
Can I just stop you? Because I feel like you're kind of reverting to your medical role here instead of... You know, I was presenting a legal question. Under 3.310, which is the secondary service connection regulation, would it allow secondary service connection on a correlation basis, given that it talks about proximately due to or the result of?
I'm not sure, but I know the answer, Your Honor. I can only say that in my experience from that most of the time it deals with correlation, and I don't really know if there is any other test that needs to be satisfied in a veteran disability. It's that a certain condition is more likely in a group, like as I said with the Agent Orange, and I don't think that most of the time we don't really know the mechanism. If you can help me out by telling me what else is in that regulation, because I'm not familiar with the regulation.
Okay. I have some questions. First of all, are you still a licensed physician?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I have to admit, I was a little confused by the brief you presented to this court. You start out with your first argument section that says that you're a lawyer, but you're also a doctor, and that the board erred when it said there were no other opinions. And then you kind of end it there, and you don't make any argument about is your opinion entitled to weight or anything else that would ordinarily go with having provided an opinion. And then you go into the next argument, which talks about the article that you submitted in conjunction with your brief to the board and the Milosiewicz article, and that the board needs to send it to an expert to review. If you're providing an opinion, why aren't you the expert? So how did the board err in not providing it to an expert? So that you understand the tension that I'm confused by there?
Well, the tension was that they basically decided there was multiple steps. First, they said there was no expert opinion. Then they said, we'll take care of it ourselves, and they did not have an expert opinion for their opinion, and they made scientifically inaccurate three three errors in their evaluation. I'm citing Old Day, which is number 7, and page number 7, and Colvin for the proposition that they cannot do it. If they did not like the... I'm sorry.
But if they... If you provided an expert opinion, why are you not arguing that the board erred in not relying on you and are arguing instead that they need to send it to somebody else?
Well, I basically meant that if they didn't like the opinion, they had all the right to say, we don't like your opinion, and we are asking for another opinion. There is nothing wrong with that. That's what we normally do. And actually, if you look at the language of Colvin, that's basically what he says, you know. Find another opinion.
So you're basically conceding that your opinion is not entitled to sufficient weight, that the board should have relied on it to grant the benefit.
Well, I don't concede that your opinion does not require weight. I think that your opinion has a lot of weight, but I'm also accepting the fact that normally what I've seen with the board is that they have matching those opinion against another opinion, and in this particular case, there was no other opinion. There was my opinion, and then there was the board's opinion. There wasn't really any expert that they relied on, and I think that was a error that they...
How do you think the board was supposed to realize that your submission from December 2014 was supposed to be a medical opinion?
Well, there were three elements of that. First of all, the letterhead says clearly MDJD, doesn't say the law offices of David and I. So it said MDJD. The signature has MDJD. The actual opinion that is brought in, the discussion, the site and so on, are unmistakably a language that the doctor would use. So I think that at the very least they should have alerted to that. And as a secondary issue, I think that the treatise itself speaks for itself.
Getting back to your first point about the language itself or is something a doctor would use, it seems to me what you do is you quote from an article and then you quote from a board decision, but you don't say, in my opinion, blah, 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 this is because of this, or this article demonstrates that. The fact that you are a doctor and a lawyer, to me, doesn't necessarily connote to the board that you're providing an opinion. Nothing here says, in my opinion. Nothing here says that because of these things that I've pointed out to you. To me, I think you put the board in a very difficult position.
Well, I don't want to take the... I mean, I can look and see what the language was exactly used, but...
You say the veteran's sleep apnea is more likely than not secondary to service-connected. A lawyer would say that. It doesn't take a doctor to say that. If I'm advocating for my client, I would probably say, this thing is secondary to this other thing. So I just think that it's... Even if there may not be an ethical violation, I don't know that what you presented here would have looked like an opinion to the board for them to be able to consider. And that's, you know, I'm sort of having a more lower level discussion than the ethical consideration of whether you should be able to do this. So, does the board have some sort of obligation every time, let's say you're not a doctor, you're just a lawyer. Lawyers all the time we see submit treatise articles that they believe support their veterans' case. We also see veterans who are representing themselves submit articles to VA. Is it your position that VA has an obligation every time a veteran or an attorney does that to submit those materials to a doctor for examination or review?
I think that Alday and Colvin clearly state that they need a medical opinion when they deny a claim. I mean, there was a case, I believe it was Bowers.
Well, let's assume that there was a medical opinion.
Yeah.
And treatises were submitted subsequent to that opinion. Is the board, are you saying per se incapable of interpreting medical literature on its own because of Colvin?
I think that they're going through, my feeling is that because the board has made such significant errors in this particular case, then maybe it's not the best idea for the board to rely on its own unsubstantiated knowledge.
But if they'd agreed with you, it would have been okay?
I'm sorry?
If they had agreed with you, it would have been okay?
Well,
never mind.
I think that I presented a treatise that is very powerful in a case where we actually have an epidemic of sleep apnea in servicemen, 220,000 in the last 10 years, and I think that they should have taken it seriously.
I don't have any further
questions. Okay. Counselor, let me direct your attention to the record before the agency, page 25. Do you have that with you?
I'll not be able to look at it, but...
Okay. Well, it's the board's opinion. Do you have the board's opinion?
I know what the board's opinion was, yes.
Okay. If you look at page 25 of the record before the agency,
yes,
or 26 of the board's opinion, in the middle of the page, the board discusses the article that you referenced and submitted, attached
correct
to your
correct
brief, right?
Correct.
And the conclusion is the board finds that while this article supports a correlation between mental health disorders and sleep apnea, it does not support a causal relationship or specifically a finding that psychiatric disorders cause sleep apnea. The article, as you indicated, does talk about correlation. Is that correct?
Yes.
Right. But as Judge Bartley was line of questions earlier, it does not talk about a causal relationship.
Well, my understanding from the medical field, and I apologize if we not be exactly on the same understanding, but my understanding from correlation is that you have two conditions well studied, so there is no that are truly matched groups, that you have a true control and a true tested group, and then you look at the
I don't need to get into all that, really.
Yeah.
To answer my question, what I want to know is, in looking at secondary service connection, is the requirement correlation or causation? Do you
is
know?
There a requirement for causation?
If you look at the requirements in the regulation for secondary service connection, is there a requirement that there be a correlation, or is there a requirement that there be a proximately due to or result of
yeah, the
criteria?
The proximately is the issue, because in science, causation meaning that I know the mechanism. In correlation, we basically establish that it's statistically significant difference between two groups that you're looking at,
right,
to the point that there's no question that they are different.
So in the regulation, 3.310, which is required, to your knowledge, if you know?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know, and I'm saying the proximate, meaning that if there's no other explanation to explain why PTSD causes sleep apnea, ergo, it is. But
okay,
in causation, you have to also bring in, tuberculosis is caused by bacilli. That's something that you have to show the whole direction. And I think that in my second one, which I didn't bring to the board, but when I tried to illustrate it, I basically explained why PTSD causes sleep apnea. Had I done it to the board, I think that I would have had a better issue.
Okay.
And I hope that I'll have the opportunity to bring it to the board for that analysis.
I have an additional question. In cases where you provide a medical opinion as well as represent the veteran, so you're serving this dual role, do you usually charge a client separately for the medical opinion, or is that part of the... Like, did Mr. Harvey pay you for a medical opinion in this case?
No, he... Okay. Our agreement was that I'll represent him, and based on the setup that the VA established, I think it's 20% of the back pay. That's
okay.
Our agreement. There was no separate fee for the IMO. No IMO was provided. An IMO.
I thought your argument was that you provided an IMO in the text of the brief.
In this particular case?
In this particular case, yes.
I did not provide a separate IMO. I provided in the text brief, but I did not. As I said, one of the remedies, I mean, I'm learning from this case, and one of the remedies would be possibly to make clear that they understand that there will be an IMO attached to the brief when I submit the brief. And most of the time I have already an IMO from the time we are not allowed to represent client before we get an NOD. So there is an IMO on the initial claim, and I can attach it. And if I have to attach an IMO, that will make it clearer that this is the medical side and here is my legal side, but I am not going to hide behind addressing it like a different person, because it's dishonest.
Okay, but you didn't charge Mr. Harvey
separately for
an opinion.
No.
Okay. Counselor, do you have any more questions?
No.
Okay. Your additional time has expired, but I do have one other question for you. I understand you to say that you are no longer actively practicing medicine. Is that correct?
It is correct, yes.
And
I have a license, but I don't practice medicine. I don't see clients.
And when did you stop practicing medicine?
1995, I went to law school. I was a transplant surgeon here at Washington Hospital Center.
When did you stop practicing medicine?
1995, about.
1995?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mr. Morris, I gave the appellant's counsel an extra 20 minutes because the bench had a lot of questions. You may have that time if you need it.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, I have no doubt that counsel believes that what he is doing is right, but that isn't the issue before the court at this time. It is clear that giving expert medical evidence on behalf of a client to the board, while at the same time representing that client before the board and then subsequently on appeal to this court, violates Rule 3.7 of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct, undermines the spirit and purpose of the rule, and as well promotes the very risks and concerns that the rule is intended to address.
Well, doesn't Mr. Anais make the argument that that really only applies in adversary proceedings, and there are cases, I think he cited a few of them in his memo, that indicate that providing some pretrial services and other hearing-type venues, that 3.7 is not necessarily a bar?
And I would agree with a part of that statement, that yes, there has been debate in the past as to whether Rule 3.7 applies to administrative hearings generally, and there have been, and the code itself has evolved over time, and depending on how the code was worded, different courts have come down with different conclusions on that. And I think historically it was pretty clear that it only applied in courtroom proceedings. As it evolved, though, it's courts have taken different approaches as to how they apply in administrative hearings, and then within that, how they apply to ex parte proceedings and adversarial proceedings. Currently, the code as written and as modified in 2002 makes it absolutely clear that the American Bar Association intends the rules to apply to administrative hearings as a whole. And it makes no distinction between administrative hearings that are adversarial versus non-adversarial. And while there are cases that have discussed these aren't necessarily cases in jurisdictions that have adopted the most current version of both the rule and the comments to the rule. And it's largely in the comments to the rule that the ABA made clear that the Rule 3.7 applies to administrative hearings generally.
You're talking about the tribunal definition?
Yes, correct, Your Honor. So again, while there may have been debate prior to the promulgation of those comments or the adoption of those comments, and while there may still be debate in states, you know, specific states that have either worded the rule differently or not adopted the comments, and under the ABA model rules, it is no longer an issue. And again, the ABA has demonstrated that it clearly can distinguish between adversarial and non-adversarial proceedings if it so desires, and it has not done that in this case or with respect to this rule. And I think the purpose of the rule demonstrates why there would be no difference as applied in this context, in the veterans context, administratively.
I thought the purpose of the rule was to not confuse the, for example, the jury in having a hard time distinguishing between is the lawyer presenting advocacy or is the witness presenting firsthand account. And do you think the board would have a difficulty in distinguishing between somebody who is acting as an advocate and somebody who is acting as a witness?
With due respect, I slightly disagree with the characterization, but to actually address it, assuming that characterization, then yes, I think, one, this case demonstrates that it can confuse a board, but I also believe that the discussion that was just had in this courtroom illustrates how easy it is to confuse medical expertise or professional expertise with legal arguments. As far as the primary purpose of the rule, yes, the separation of argument and evidence is its primary concern, but the purpose of the rule is to protect the integrity of the legal profession and the legal system, and it does that by distinguishing between argument and evidence. One of the risks that arises when argument and evidence is presented by the same person is the confusion to the trier of fact, and not necessarily a jury, but it could be any trier of fact, or as the model rules now indicates, the tribunal, and whatever that tribunal may be. And again, as this case indicates, that it is, even with perhaps the best of intentions, it is very easy to conflate arguments and evidence and to not fully appreciate in what capacity a statement is being made.
One of your concerns that you articulated in your brief was the potential difficulty in developing evidence to assess the objectivity and credibility of the evidence when the witness is also the attorney. But based on VA's inability to develop, to deny, basically. How does that inability to develop, to deny, differ in this context than it does in the other settings where you have a witness who presents testimony at a board hearing or submits something directly to the board such that there wasn't time to look at other things before it was at the board?
Again, if one is considering that the primary purpose of the rule is to protect the integrity of, again, the legal profession and the system, I think in that context it augments the risk that of the appearance of bias, the appearance of non-objectivity, and the appearance that the integrity of the system may be strained.
I appreciate that, but it seems to me that the restrictions of the unique VA system don't differ in the context where you have an attorney presenting evidence versus a lay person presenting evidence.
That is correct. And I use those examples simply as examples to show that there are aspects of the VA system, of this VA system being a proclaimant system that do expose itself to certain risks. And you're right, that risk may exist, whether it was the attorney who provided the evidence or a different physician who provided the evidence. There's still no cross-examination. There's still no other safeguards. But the important thing is that this rule is not a rule of evidence, a rule of procedure. This is a rule that governs attorney conduct. And it's a rule that can only govern attorney conduct because it's part of the attorney's licensing and practicing. And so there may be other issues or other safeguards that are lacking in the system, and the system may have been constructed purposely to avoid those traditional safeguards. It doesn't change the fact that the model rules of professional conduct govern the behavior of the attorney generally and not how the system uses evidence or may potentially allow for the rebuttal of evidence.
Appellant's counsel suggested that it would be a hardship to his client for him to withdraw or not offer his medical expertise. I take it you don't agree with that.
No, I would start, Your Honor, by noting that the counsel has not been asked to withdraw by VA. No action was taken against counsel in this case. This is not a case that stems from administrative discipline that we are arguing at this point. In fact, the essence of the issue in this case arose in the Secretary's response to appellant's allegation that he had raised a medical opinion, and the Secretary had responded by arguing that the opinion was not reasonably raised, notwithstanding any violation of any particular rules. The Secretary cited to the model rules as further evidence that it was not unreasonable for the Board to assume that counsel acted within the constraints of his own profession.
But the Board did address the article.
As the Board is required to do in cases when evidence is submitted, and it did address the article, and it's the Secretary's position that it addressed it reasonably and that its findings with respect to the article were certainly reasonable.
And is there any harm in not then addressing what counsel has labeled in a medical opinion?
If we take this out of the context of the model rules and the propriety of raising it the way that it was raised, in a case where a medical opinion was submitted separate and apart from treatises that were relied on by that medical expert, I would say that the Board would still be required to discuss that opinion, because the opinion is based on medical evidence. That for the Board to simply look at the underlying medical evidence may be able to discredit part of that, but we still have to discuss the opinion. In this case, we don't have a clearly presented opinion. It's the Secretary's position still that it was not a reasonably raised medical opinion, notwithstanding any violation of the rules.
Continuing a little bit of the discussion I had with your opposing counsel, how should the Board react to treatise evidence that is submitted by an appellant or appellant's counsel? Why should they be able to interpret complex medical questions or discussions in a treatise themselves?
For the same reason that appellant's counsels generally can submit those treatise evidence, based on the implicit recognition of their ability to read what is partially written for lay people. The issue arises when one is forming a medical conclusion about the treatise, and not when one is simply reading the treatise, the basic language of it. That there is a fine line, that on a case-by-case basis, there are times where one might overstep the boundaries of what's permissible to infer from a medical treatise, but discussing that the treatise is not something that only a medical expert could do.
If the court were to find that a lawyer could be a witness, would the proper remedy here be to remand for the Board to review and address the opinion presented by appellant's counsel?
With due respect, I'm not sure how the court could reach that result given the clarity of the rule. But the remedy would still be what the Secretary argued in his brief, that even assuming that it was permissible for appellant's counsel to offer a medical opinion, that in this case it was not reasonably raised medical opinion. It was raised in the context of a legal brief which I believe began with the statement that this is the veteran's legal representative, and the only indication of any medical expertise was in the suffix added to the name, which bore MD as well as JD. But there is otherwise no indication, and the statement itself bore no indication that it was intended to be medical evidence. And I suppose in my own experience, I've seen that statement made countless times by counsel. It is just as much a legal argument, as this court pointed out earlier, as it would be potentially in a different context, a medical opinion. So the relief would still be the same, which would be the affirmance of the board's decision and the finding that the board was not unreasonable in failing to discern or decipher the statement as a medical opinion.
Well, let me get back to some of the record questions that I asked appellant's counsel. So the board here relied on a 2013 VA opinion to deny service connection. Is that opinion part of the record?
I am not positive. If it is not a part of the record, it's because it was not a matter that was raised, and therefore not one that, at the time of the briefing, one that I believe needed to be directly addressed. Or rather, is it a part of the record of proceedings, I assume, was the question. I'm not positive. The propriety or the merit or the adequacy of that examination were not argued. The arguments were very specific as to the board's failure to discuss the counsel's statement as a medical opinion and its discussion of the treatise evidence.
You do reference that opinion in your brief, but it unfortunately, I didn't see it in the ROP.
And I do apologize for the oversight in failing to include it.
And then the question that I asked the Appellant's counsel, do you know whether he had additional attachments other than the Malaysiawicz article? Because his brief to the board indicated that there was a numerical list of attachments, and I didn't see the numerical list of attachments, and I only saw one attachment, which was the text of the Malaysiawicz article.
To the best of my recollection, there was no list, although that article that you're referring to, I do believe, has a number on it, which would be
number 9. Right.
Number 9. As far as the pages in between, I don't recall whether there was any additional information. Again, the secretary submitted what was relevant to the arguments that were raised and the issues that were raised in this case. And again, I can only speculate as to what was in between it, perhaps the envelope, but it was not germane to the issues that were raised at the time of the briefing.
Okay. I think you can look forward to a forthcoming order from the court so that we, know what the VA's medical opinion that they based their decision on looked like, and also what the actual brief that was submitted to the board looked like. I mean, if this is the extent of it, that's fine. But it did indicate that there were further attachments than just one.
And I would respectfully submit that even still, the appellant has not challenged the adequacy of that examination, therefore has not raised any issue with respect to its adequacy. The board made findings of fact based on that examination, and I would suggest that that the matter as to the adequacy of it is not currently before the court, at least as raised by the parties. However, the secretary will certainly submit whatever documents the court is looking for. If I may, I don't have much.
Well, I have a few questions for you, Mr. Morris. What is the guidance that you give the board in situations like this?
In this situation, because it did not become clear that the appellant intended to raise medical opinion until we got to the briefing stage and he admitted to that potential, to that arguable infraction of the model code. I'm not aware of any specific guidelines of the board in terms of how to, in every instance, address issues of professional code violations. And my lack of awareness of that is not indicative of the lack of any such policies. But the application of these, uh, of, or administrative decisions to discipline are discretionary decisions, and the code does not exist solely for the purpose of being enforced. In fact, the first threshold is the attorney's conduct itself, and it is written for attorneys to avoid the conduct and not just simply for disciplinary purposes. So I would submit that regardless of how the Secretary approaches these in a case-by-case analysis, it is still incumbent upon every counsel to abide by the rules.
So what should counsel do? What should counsel have done? I'm looking at a board decision that appellant's counsel referenced in his brief that the board had no problems entertaining the alleged medical opinion that was contained in the material submitted and ruled in favor of appellant's counsel's position after weighing the evidence. Is this a process that you are encouraging the board to engage in? Does this violate 3.7? I mean, there has to be some guidance here.
It would certainly violate Rule 3.7 for an attorney submitting or giving expert evidence at the same time as representing a client. But again, it's not the sole responsibility of the secretary to take it. Disciplinary action in every case. The obligation falls onto the attorney. This is a rule that governs attorney conduct as part of a legal profession, and the first and foremost responsibility is that of the attorney. And violating a rule multiple times.
Mr. Morris, if you will, the point is the board is entertaining medical opinions from an attorney.
Correct.
Now you're telling me that this is not the board's responsibility, the secretary's responsibility, it's an attorney's responsibility. Well, if the attorney continues to do that, what's the board going to do? Continue to accept the information and rule on it? And is that how it should go?
One could potentially argue against future administrative action that the secretary has accepted a practice and therefore shouldn't punish an attorney, but it does not change the fact that the attorney shouldn't have done that in the first place, nor did repeated violations make it right.
Again, what guidance do you offer the board?
At this time, I'm not aware of the guidance that has or may be offered to the board. Clearly, this is the first time that this matter has been litigated.
Well, it's the first time it's come here.
Litigated.
But apparently it's at the board a lot.
By the appellant's statement, he submitted about three of these clearly marked independent opinions. And whether the board is not the sole entity that would be responsible for any type of administrative action. So it would not necessarily be in a board decision. And perhaps the board in any particular case might have considered that the harm at that point to the veteran might have been greater than the benefits of removing counsel.
Okay.
But it doesn't mean that the agency itself cannot then or even any time in the future continue to investigate the issue and determine whether to take appropriate...
So I guess that leads you to the next question. Moving forward, then, what guidance, given 3.7's language, might be considered for the board?
So the guidance going forward begins with the... It is now being public that the secretary is taking the position that it is a violation of the model rule of professional conduct to engage in this type of dual capacity role.
Okay, and if there is a violation, then what are you suggesting is the remedy?
The remedy to any violation, first and foremost, would fall under the Secretary's regulations, which govern the codes of conduct. And those regulations, while they look towards the model rules as guidance, also have several other parameters, other codes of standards of conduct. And so how the Secretary approached it would depend on the case-by-case analysis in any case, perhaps. Perhaps it would be the removal of an attorney. Perhaps it would be some form of disciplinary sanctioning. But again, the rule is clear. The attorney is the one who is responsible for removing him from that situation. And in this case, what we have and what I've gathered both from the conversation is that this is an intended objective to provide a medical opinion in a case where one is needed, where one becomes necessary. And that certainly would violate not just the language of the rule itself, but again, the spirit and purpose of the rule. to actively seek a client with the intention of engaging in a action that is prohibited by the rule of conduct.
If Mr. Anais is licensed in the state of Arizona, which I'm assuming that's where he is since that's where he lives, should we look to instead to the rules of conduct from the Arizona bar or as opposed to the model rules?
My response is twofold. This court may take action as it deems fit, and this court's rules contemplate the adoption of the model rules of professional conduct. With respect to the agency or with respect to a different issue posed to the court, that there would be occasion to also look at Arizona's rules. VA's regulation does cite that as one basis for disciplinary action or in terms of the code of conduct of an attorney. They have to abide by their own state's jurisdiction. I would note in this case, though, that inasmuch as the argument had been raised that not every state has adopted the comments to the rule, that Arizona is one of those states that has. Arizona has adopted both the model rules and the comments as they were amended in 2002. So we would reach no different result in this case, notwithstanding state law, jurisprudence.
Okay, given that you argued in your brief or supplement that two things, you argued that violation of Rule 3.7, and you also argued that the format here was simply wrong, and so because it was kind of the medical opinion was joined in the brief, and it wasn't clear that there even was a medical opinion there. So given your view that 3.7 is more just a guidance for lawyers' conduct, then you're not really sure what the VA as a department would do in this case or whether it would take any action against Mr. Anais. Is your better argument that we just say that there's no opinion here? Because of the formatting issue, or it wasn't clear that there was an opinion here?
In this case, absolutely, and that was the position that the Secretary took in his brief, was that there was no reasonably raised medical opinion. The rules that govern an attorney's conduct aren't rules that govern the subsequent treatment of evidence, and it would not have any necessary bearing on the competence of that evidence or the persuasiveness of that evidence. It is a rule that simply prohibits that attorney from introducing this evidence as a matter of professional responsibility. So it was the Secretary's position in this brief, not that the purported statement should have been struck or excluded, because the rule doesn't necessarily speak to that direction. What the rule requires is that the attorney remove himself from the situation so that we never end up in this type of litigation. We did end up in this type of litigation, and in this particular case, the attorney's statement was clearly not clearly a medical opinion, and it was certainly not unreasonable for the board to view it as part of a legal argument, which the board did address, and the board did address the treatises that were associated with that argument. So in this case, there is no error on the part of the board, and the remedy specific to the board's decision would be the affirmance of that decision. And if there are no further questions, because...
So, to be clear, you are seeking a remedy from this court that is simply an affirmance of the board's decision.
We're seeking an affirmance of the board's decision and an affirmation of the Secretary's position to the extent that it was an issue that the court inquired about. And that position, again, is that the conduct engaged in this case, whether for the right reasons or not, was a violation of the model rules of professional conduct. And that regardless of the manner in which a medical opinion is presented, if it is presented by an attorney who is simultaneously representing the claimant, that it would be a violation of that rule.
Very good. Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you.
Mr. Nice, you have 10 minutes for your rebuttal.
I have basically only one comment. We have had the supplemental hearing during that time. The Secretary have done due diligence of reviewing all the literature, all the case law that deals with Model Rule 3.7. He provided the court with almost 10 citations. And he appears today and said that it's no question that the Model Rule 3.7 applies to the BVA. And I don't see a single case that he cited that deals with the BVA. I don't see any case from the court that deals with any ethical violation regarding 3.7 at this court level. I did not see any case that he cited that deals with an expert witness, and I don't see any case that did not deal with a jury trial, eyewitness. These are all the cases that the Secretary have provided. So I think that if we stay within the four corners of what we already have, we don't have any evidence that 3.7 applies to the BVA. In the contrary, the cases that the Secretary provided show that in the cases where deal with the judges, there is no problem. Cases that are like pretrial motions, including summary judgment, are not even an issue. So the way that the BVA practices by providing briefs and interruption is very similar to a pretrial motion. The cases that he presented also show that the judges are not confused. The judges are not swayed by the fact that the attorney is also the witness. So I think that if we just rely on what the Secretary provided this court, we should hold that it's the motor rule is totally inapplicable to the BVA on several grounds. On the ground that it's a non-adversarial procedure, and the restatement clearly states that if it's an adversarial position on Chapter 108, then it doesn't hold. That the person who conducts the hearing is a judge and not a jury, and the fact that the testimony is not a necessary testimony but rather an expert testimony, I don't really see that the Secretary produced a single citation of why we should apply Rule 3.7 to the bar, clearly not accept it on faith. That's all I have, Your Honor.
Well, counsel, I think you're walking a fine line here, and you may have crossed it. But thank you. The case will be submitted. For consideration, the court will now come down to greet counsel.